Ja, hallo.
Good afternoon. We're delighted to see so many of you here with us today. And we'd like to say thank you, first of all, to the team of curators who invited us, and also to the organization team and the technical team who helped us to get everything organized here. And thank you to the previous speaker as well. And indeed, all the speakers of the last few days have opened up a whole host of new perspectives on our own topic for us.
In
2010, shortly before the beginning of the Arab Spring, around the world, the prices for wheat and maize doubled. This was explained inter alia with the increases in meat consumption in China and India, and more generally with the booming world population. It was only much later that it became clear that large pension investment funds needed to find new possibilities to invest after the collapse of the American real estate market. Billions flowed into commodity futures on staple foods, sending the prices sky high and completely ignoring the fatal consequences for the local population in states who had to import wheat. And that's one example of the way in which trade and dealing with the most traditional forms of derivatives, with commodity futures, can impact upon the world situation. But these derivatives, which relate to commodities such as wheat, gold, or pork bellies, constitute less than 1% of all of the derivatives that are traded. More than 90% are financial derivatives, and that makes very clear what a powerful effect they can have and what can be achieved deploying financial derivatives. In the next half hour, we're going to talk about the always ambivalent relationship between the state and the world of finance has been dramatically changed. The nature of that relationship has changed since the 1970s, leading to new peak profits and losses and a fruitful interpenetration of the two realms. What are derivatives? They come in many shapes and forms, with melodious names: futures, forwards, options, swaps, collateral debt obligations, exchange-traded funds, and so on and so forth. There's one thing that all derivatives have in future. They're directed to the future under enormously complex contracts. The partners in this contractual setup bet against each other that the underlying value will change. They bet on the future price development of this underlying. You can buy and sell derivatives without actually owning the underlying asset, or indeed even owning a portion thereof. And they have a very ingenious leverage effect, which means you can invest a small amount and win an enormous multiple thereof, or indeed lose an enormous multiple thereof. That's what's known as leverage. But derivatives don't generate value per se. What one side wins, the other must lose. Derivatives also serve as a form of investment which escapes state control, just like gold. But in contrast to precious metals, there's no material limitation to derivatives. They can be created ad infinitum and turned into money. Officially, the function of derivatives is described as being a tool for price determination and for risk management, which we'll be coming back to later. And we decided to make our presentation in German because we thought it might be more straightforward, but then we had to translate all the terms from the world of finance that we'd learnt in English and transpose those into German. And the terms that sound so nice and elegant in English sound a bit clunky on occasion in German. They're much more complex terms and not quite so zippy as they are in English.
Of the American dollar as a pillar of monetary stability around the world. In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold. I'm determined that the American dollar must never again be a hostage in the hands of international speculators.
With his speech of the 15th of August, Richard Nixon de facto brought an end to the Bretton Woods Agreement. The point wasn't simply about not releasing any gold temporarily. The measure was embedded in a whole series of repressive measures by the Nixon administration, which aimed to devalue the dollar in relation to European currencies and the yen. And this TV speech of Nixon is second to none in terms of its demagogical thrust. He pretended to the people that the US economy, which was under enormous pressure, was actually the victim of international speculation, but it was precisely his government who was opening the door wide to those speculators. Preceding that speech, there had been protectionist measures which attained international competition through straightforward blackmail. Japan and Korea were forced to accept voluntary quotas for textile exports to the USA. The German Bundesbank, the central bank in Germany, was warned that the American troops could be withdrawn from Germany if the Germans were to use their right to change dollars for gold. And that list goes on and on. Over the entire decade, the situation escalated. In order to finance the Vietnam War, the US increased the money supply, which increased inflation and further damaged confidence in the dollar. The stagflation of the North American economy persisted despite all government efforts until the 1980s. The United States indirectly forced their partners to purchase dollars, the EC, Japan, Korea, Switzerland. That was the only way that they could ensure that their currency did not appreciate still further. That meant the USA could consolidate the position of the dollar as an anchor currency, as it still is today. And they also simultaneously solved their debt crisis. The trading partners took on board the US foreign debt and at the same time accepted that it would not be repaid. Leo Melamed, head of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, dreamt of a future on currencies and an exchange that would deal only with financial instruments. Nowadays, that seems not so unusual. But back then, it was absolutely unheard of. He called it a maverick idea, a real one-off. What's important for us is that this idea came into being against the backdrop of a crumbling system of fixed exchange rates, but did indeed grow out of the logic of trading in traditional commodity futures. In other words, it's not that there was a need to hedge against fluctuating exchange rates, and therefore a corresponding tool was created. Quite the opposite. It was the other way around. The first financial derivatives were developed in keeping with the logic of commodity futures exchanges. And this logic states that if you accept a certain degree of abstraction, you can invent a future or an option on anything.
A futures exchange that would deal exclusively in monetary instruments. The first instrument was to be the real thing, money. Instinctively, I knew there was a tremendous opportunity in this new contract. And something else. No one could squeeze and corner a currency market. Economics was going to dictate the market.
Leo Melamed machte sich an die
Arbeit. Leo Melamed set to work in order to get the ball rolling for his idea of a market that would focus primarily on making money. At the University of Chicago at that time, Milton Friedman was teaching, an economist who Melamed very much admired. He contacted Friedman and asked him for support. In August 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, Friedman wrote a statement for Melamed for $5,000.
The need for futures markets and currencies. The US is in many ways a natural place for the major futures markets to develop. And it is very much in the national interest that the futures market and currencies should develop here. The US is a natural place for the futures market because the dollar is almost certain to continue to be the major intervention currency for central banks and the major vehicle currency for international transactions.
That was the start of a long friendship. Milton Friedman's support opened doors to high-up experts and influential figures. The then finance minister, George Shultz, and Friedman knew each other personally. As Melamed wrote, he visited Washington and focused there not on whether the new market was compatible with existing legislation, but on an ideological agreement. Although there were numerous provisions on commodity futures, particularly for agricultural products, the new exchange was opened and trading began without anyone knowing exactly how the whole thing was going to develop, and above all, without any specific regulations. The following decades were shaped by the inventive spirit of financial experts, intensive lobbying by the Oldboy Network, and the struggle between regulators and free market apologists. Here you can see a few photographs from Leo Melamed's website, the Gallery of Leaders. I'm sure you recognize all these figures. There's Hillary. Many international connections as well. And the Fed played a role as well, of course, last but not least. However, from the exotic and eccentric niche market, the largest market of the world developed, and for that to happen, the first financial derivatives needed to draw on models from an entirely different realm. And to understand this, you have to understand the specific nature of derivatives and their significance within the capitalist financial system. Derivatives carry out essentially two tasks or roles. They allow companies, countries, and investors to shift risks to a contractual partner, and at the same time, they're highly optimized tools to make money from more money without the burden of ownership or work. So they are at one and the same time insurance and a speculative instrument. In the ideal scenario, the instrument ensures profit with no risk whatsoever. So what's being traded is, in a sense, risk, which is quantifiable and commoditized. The crux of the matter then was how to compute a price for risk. In 1973, Black, Shultz and Merton developed a formula on calculation of option prices, and that was the initial spark that set off the explosive growth of the derivatives market. Friedman's Positive Economics, published in 1953, was the forerunner and basis, paving the way for the new economic models. Contrary to the predominant orthodox consensus, which said that the basic tenets must echo reality,
and hypothesis will be found to have assumptions that are wildly inaccurate descriptive representations of reality. A hypothesis is important if it explains much by little, if it abstracts the common and crucial elements from the mass of complex and detailed circumstances, and permits valid predictions on the basis of them alone. To be important, therefore, a hypothesis must be descriptively false in its assumptions.
At the same time, a whole series of researchers began to formulate fundamental new assumptions pertaining to financial markets and to verify those, they increasingly used mathematical formulae. The computers available at the time had a ridiculously scant amount of computing capacity, and hence the basic assumptions had to be so simplified that they idealized the empirical observations or entirely contradicted them. Positive economics was very opportune and helped the previously ridiculed discipline of financial mathematics to take on a whole new importance at universities. Although they were enormously controversial, and still are, the fundamental theories of these foundational years still form the underpinning for all formula and calculations in financial economics. For example, the idea of rational agents, the hypothesis of efficient markets, and the random walk model. We've prepared an experiment here to illustrate the random walk model.
Random
walk is an example of the way in which models from the world of physics can be transposed to the world of economics, which means that unpredictable correlations can suddenly be predicted and computed. It was originally used to describe the movement of particles in gases or liquids, Brownian motion. In the world of economics, the assertion is that just like particles, the movement of prices on the market is at any moment unpredictable and independent of all previous price steps. The key point is that if price movements are a random walk, then the entire arsenal of mathematical probability theory can be applied to these markets. In the 20th century, what was particularly popular was standard distribution. It was applied to all statistical correlations and ultimately also to price trends. That was a fatal choice, as a matter of fact, for standard distribution focuses primarily on slight differences, large-scale deviations, in other words, really dangerous price fluctuations, tend to be neglected. And that means that the risk of extreme events in the price of derivatives is entirely underestimated. I was trying to show you that here, but it didn't exactly work quite as I wanted to. The blindness as to these extreme deviations arises from the fact that the probability space underlying every standard distribution, in our case, this aquarium setup, cannot actually be applied to price trends. This space of price movements is the social space, which perpetually comes into being anew on the basis of complex relationships and interactions in globalized societies. In the setting of volatile exchange rates, free trade agreements, outsourcing of production, and tax cuts, which has pertained since the 70s, new derivatives ensure hedging against new risks becomes possible all the time, and more risk. In other words, scope for speculation, including gigantic leverage and short selling, leverages the financial world into an era of ecstasy, irrational exuberance. In a closed loop, the new wealth of financial traders, the normative validity and the deregulation of derivatives markets, and orientation of state decisions to the market causes all kinds of problems in an economic system in which production is outsourced to the countries with the lowest labour costs and is often distributed over several countries. Banks offer their clients tailor-made derivatives for their very specific hedging needs. These over-the-counter derivatives make up 85% of the total market. The most frequently traded OTC derivatives are interest rate and currency swaps. The fantastic thing about OTC derivatives is that the trade is entirely intransparent. It's only the bank that knows the details. In the 90s, the seed of this huge package of different elements began to sprout. It contained an intuitively plausible theory and practical successes that arose from it. By now, an entire generation of students from the economics faculties have taken on leadership positions in banks and in the state, and carried with them the conviction that markets are the best decision maker for almost all societal tasks. There was an orgy of deregulation under Clinton that slots into this whole situation. The crowning achievement of this was the Community Futures Modernisation Act in 2000. All of the old-fashioned obstacles to speculation, for example, with food, were simply removed. And OTC trading, which was anyway completely non-transparent, was removed completely from the frame of control. To give you an idea of what the kind of trading we're talking about actually signifies, we've prepared this graph. I'm going to show you the notional value now. In formal terms, the amount of derivatives in billions of US dollars from 1970 to 2010. We've got them marked up here in trillions. So I'm starting down here at the bottom. It's not terribly precise. But we've got enormous growth in the 80s, which you can't necessarily see precisely with this sticky tape. And then comes the Clinton era. When momentum developed, in 1989, $10 trillion US dollar were traded. In 1990, $100 trillion. And now, after the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, there's no stopping them. And in 2007, we shoot right off the graph, just in time for the crisis. And without really understanding why the financial sector had this huge negotiating clout when it came to dealing with the consequences of the financial crisis, here's all of the zeros for the figure that I just cited to you. In 2007, we shoot right off the graph. World GDP around the entire world is $58 trillion. So, round about here. So you can see the proportions and how they relate to each other. And it really is rather striking. In the 30 years from 1973 to the millennium, in fact, just after the millennium, the balance of power between nation states and the world of finance changed fundamentally on all different levels. Former bank managers such as Robert Rubin became advisors in the White House and subsequently ministers of finance. The issue here is not exclusively a question of direct influence, but the financial sector is suddenly cool, and its representatives are much sought after everywhere. They're the new conjurers, not just creating wealth out of nothing with derivatives, but practicing the ultimate form of governance, governing homo economicus, as Foucault said, without touching him. And this constellation, derivatives, are the rabbit in the conjurer's hat. And once that rabbit is out of the hat, it will really pester and bother the audience, and indeed the general public. This is from our film, Fictions and Futures, Part 1.
What's wrong with silver? Price is the language of the market. The market speaks to us through prices. However, it cannot express consensus of any kind. Now, consider a simple sale. 50 futures of US corn number 2 at $5 a bushel. The seller has to believe that a bushel of corn is worth less than $5. And the buyer has to believe that a bushel is worth more than $5. $5, then, does not represent any agreement whatsoever between seller and buyer. Price is the current level of disagreement. And yet price creates our reality.
Für Staaten sind zur Finanzierung.
Swaps are of particular interest to the state to fund their budget. This is something that all states do on a large scale to secure themselves against, for example, interest rate fluctuations. With somewhat more complex swaps, you can also transfer debts elegantly to the future and thus remove them from your books as if by magic. This trick was used by many large-scale banks, particularly in the Eurozone and in countries which had trouble with adhering to the 3% deficit rule. Germany was long no exception to this, but it hit the headlines when Greece took this approach. In 2001, shortly before entering the euro, they entered a deal with Goldman Sachs, cross-currency swaps based on fictive exchange rates. The public deficit was cut by 2.4 billion euros, but shortly after that, with some bad luck, they ended up with 5.1 billion debt as a result of this. The bank, as advisor to Greece, knew the actual situation and had immediately hedged against credit default risk with other derivatives. To put it in less positive terms, they'd placed a bet against their own business partner, and they ended up with 500 million fees as well. Mario Draghi, at the time, was managing director at the international division of Goldman Sachs. 10 years later, as head of ECB, he played a key role in the devastating so-called rescue of Greece. So just to avoid any misunderstandings, the states of the capitalist metropoles and metropolises are not victims. They use derivatives markets for their own national interests. And indeed, and this is not just a question of Greece, they use them as an invisible instrument of power that they exercise over the peripheral countries. The price of currencies is influenced by the derivatives market. Information shapes the trends, and soft currencies have no defences against this. Once the depreciation trend kicks in, it goes on millions of times over and in millisecond speed. The trend is your friend for indebted states and their populations. The cynical advice is capitalism is something you have to be able to afford. In 2003, Buffett said, derivatives are weapons of mass destruction.
Krise von 2008 legte off.
2008 crisis made clear what Buffett meant by that. In the USA alone, 10 million people were evicted from 4 million houses. There was foreclosures every single minute in the courts. It was an unprecedented legal bloodbath in the interest of investment protection. Calls to ban the derivatives market, or at least to restrict them, were branded Luddite and rebellious. The political class had so internalised the idea of the primacy of markets that it never even occurred to them to help people. Instead, it was the banks which were saved. We can draw several conclusions from this. In the crisis scenario of a looming systemic collapse, the nation states will jump in as the final guarantor of private capital. Too big to fail means that states shoulder the extreme risks of banks and thus implicitly subsidise derivatives. For if the full risk factor were factored into derivatives, derivatives would have to be much more expensive. As Dan Green once said, price is the last dictator. And finally, the world of finance has forced the nation states to help, demonstrating at the same time the quasi-collapse of their power. We've got so much leverage. So, we draw to an end now. In industrial capitalism, there was an inextricable connection between money production and the nation state. In the era of supranational capitalism, markets transcended national sovereignty and degraded states, turning them into mere service providers, guaranteeing enforcement of business contracts through their legal systems. The only other thing that's left for states to do is to optimise their infrastructure and human capital in order to be able to hold their own in the competition, to gain capital flow with good ratings. Derivatives are involved in this process on all levels. They enable rating of companies and states in real time. This kind of means to exert pressure shaping political processes on semi-natural authority. There's no central banker or minister who's not aware of the punitive super-ego of the markets every time he or she opens his mouth. The status quo could be seen as an alliance between supranational finance and the nation states, the worst of both worlds. But this monster is not necessarily the end of the story. If you look at the seemingly implacable extension of this system, we might address two equally unpleasant scenarios: an environmental catastrophe triggered by global warming and resource depletion, or a nationalist backlash, the kind that we see in many places around the world currently. Most people are busy organising their everyday life, yet in parallel, bills are passed every day, financial instruments invented, regulation dumbed down, and international treaties concluded. And these all affect our lives. At the end, we will be resented with the bill. If we want to be able to contest that bill, we need to update our economic know-how. The next crisis is certainly around the corner, that much is for sure. Instead of just watching again as the nation states rescue financial markets, saving their own skin in the process, we could try out a reset for a change. Thank you.